The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, the world watched as its most famous living scientist celebrated his 70th birthday. Even those who don't know a thing about science will know the name, Professor Stephen Hawking. They know that his story is a symbol of the triumph of willpower over adversity. To celebrate his 70 years, Professor Hawking's colleagues at Cambridge University, where he was the Lucasian Professor of Mathematics until recently, had arranged for 4 days of celebrations. These included 3 days of cutting-edge cosmology presented by a dream team of the world's leading theoretical physicists. There were Nobel laureates here, current and future, and some of the most indescribably hard mathematics about black holes, quantum gravity, and multiverses. On the fourth day, the celebrations went public with a series of talks on dark energy and the search for life on other planets. I was there for most of it, and in this podcast, you'll hear from just a few of the leading physicists in attendance. There was one omission over the weekend of celebrations, and it's a big one. Professor Hawking himself was only there in spirit due to ill health. Physical setbacks, though, have never stopped this man. On his birthday, on Sunday, January the 8th, 2012, he crowned the celebrations with these words to a packed hall in Cambridge.
I am very thankful to be here today. Now that I have reached 3 score years and 10, I hope you will forgive me for looking back over my life and how our understanding of the state of the universe has changed. I will also try to look forward beyond the present horizon. I was born on January 8, 1942, exactly 300 years after the death of Galileo. However, I estimate that about 200,000 other babies were also born that day. I don't know whether any of them were later interested in astronomy. I was born in Oxford, even though my parents were living in London. This was because Oxford was a good place to be born during World War II. The Germans had an agreement that they would not bomb Oxford and Cambridge in return for the British not bombing Heidelberg and Göttingen. It is a pity that this civilized sort of arrangement couldn't have been extended to more cities. Neither my father nor my mother were well off when they married. My father was a Yorkshireman and he did research on tropical diseases. My mother was one of 7 children and met my father while also studying at Oxford. We lived in a tall, narrow Victoria house in Highgate, which my parents had bought very cheaply during the war, when everyone thought London was going to be bombed flat. In fact, a V-2 rocket landed a few houses away from ours. I was away with my mother and sister at the time, and fortunately my father was not hurt. For years afterwards there was a large bomb site down the road, in which I used to play. At that time, during and just after the war, Highgate was an area in which a number of scientific and academic people lived. In another country they would have been called intellectuals, but the English have never admitted to having any intellectuals. All these parents sent their children to Byron House School, which was a very progressive school for those times. I remember complaining to my parents that they weren't teaching me anything. They didn't believe in what was then the accepted way of drilling things into you. Instead, you were supposed to learn to read without realizing you were being taught. In the end, I did learn to read, but not until the fairly late age of 8. Another early memory was getting my first train set. I had a passionate interest in model trains, and in fact, I even dreamed about electric trains. I was always very interested in how things operated, and used to take them apart to see how they worked, but I was not so good at putting them back together again. My practical abilities never matched up to my theoretical inquiries.
Stephen Hawking's ability to wrong-foot expectations and confound people has stayed with him to this very day, as has his humour and air of eccentricity. At the scientific seminar in Cambridge, I spoke to Kitty Ferguson, the author of a new biography called Stephen Hawking, His Life and Work. I started by asking her about Hawking's seeming lack of promise as a child.
According to his mother, the people who knew him then, he really didn't bother to learn anything or work on anything that he didn't feel a need to know. And you can't really get by too well in school doing that. So he was pretty far down in his class. But even then, his friends called him Einstein. And so either they thought he was very eccentric, or he was really brilliant, or probably both. But he and his friends involved themselves in building fireworks in the conservatory and all kinds of crazy things like that. His family were in St. Albans, and it was a very eccentric family, a very loving family. But they were eccentric. They had a reputation for doing so much reading that when people would visit them and sit down for dinner with them, the whole Hawking family was just buried in their books. Now, some people say that's not true, but other people's, I guess it was people, different people's experiences. And he and his, he was the oldest of the siblings, but he and his sister, the next one, Mary, devised as many ways as they could find of getting in and out of that house, which was a big old, drafty, almost a mansion, in and out of it by ways without using the front door or using the back door, just secret ways to get in and out. And he evidently came up with 11 different ways. And I'd be interested in knowing, you know, what on earth.
That paper's not been published yet, clearly.
No, that's right. That hasn't been published. Those maps are lost. But when he was in what we call sixth form age, he and his friends built a computer, which was quite a task. I mean, they just took all kinds of spare parts from every which place and built this computer. And that's something I wish we still had. Whatever remained of it was thrown away by one of the teachers at the St. Albans School, who just was doing some house cleaning and tossed it out without realizing what it was. Maybe before Stephen Hawking had really made a reputation, but that's a shame. That would be a great artifact.
When did he get into physics? When was there a moment, or was it just something that from school he was interested in science and it just developed from there?
It was about the time he started at Oxford he was interested in physics, but not so much in mathematics. And I think later on, when he got here to Cambridge, he regretted the fact that he had not studied more mathematics at Oxford, because he had to struggle when he got here as a beginning graduate student with general relativity and all the mathematics that goes with that. It was quite a struggle. But he had a wonderful time at Oxford. He was a coxswain on a boat, and almost too good a time. He almost didn't graduate with a first-class degree, and if he hadn't graduated with a first-class degree, he wouldn't have come here to Cambridge. So he was quite a character. I mean, you read about those years, too, and he was an arrogant kid, smart, very smart, worked only, again, on things that interested him.
So this smart, arrogant kid, first-class degree, comes to Cambridge to do a PhD, and then we all know what happens next. He's diagnosed with motor neurone disease. When did that happen, and how did he respond to it?
Well, the way he describes it, he holed himself up in his room, listened to a lot of Richard Wagner, thought of himself as a tragic hero, just really went through the mill, you know, trying to come to terms with it, not knowing exactly what he was coming to terms with, how long it was going up, how fast it would take over, and getting... he was, you know, pretty down. It was really a bad time. Why shouldn't it be? I mean, it's a terrible thing.
How old was he?
He was 21. So just at the beginning of his, you know, his adult life. And that was about the time that he first met Jane Wilde, who became Jane Hawking, his first wife. And she had a great deal to do with his developing the will to live at that time. And I think he has said since that he would never have been able to do what he's done without her. And especially during those first years when she had an optimism and an enthusiasm that he found contagious. And they finally decided that they were going to be able to accomplish something in spite of his problems. And it's a very moving story, really, because their courtship and their marriage took place in the context of his coming to terms with his illness and also the beginning of his career. So everything was happening at once.
I mean, and also the doctors at the time didn't give him many years to live.
They gave him 2 years to live. But Jane Hawking has actually said that one of the things that made that less discouraging than it might seem was that this was a period, and I can remember this too because I'm the same age as Stephen, when everybody sort of thought the world was going to end in a nuclear disaster. And so you kind of thought, well, maybe none of us has more than 2 years to live.
So in the mid-1960s, in the cauldron of his early 20s, with the diagnosis of what was assumed a terminal illness, Stephen Hawking found love and a fresh desire to push at the boundaries of his understanding of the cosmos. Working in tandem with the great British physicist Roger Penrose, Hawking extended what scientists thought about the weird bits of space-time called singularities. These are places where the known laws of physics seem to break down. They're also the objects inside black holes, and nothing can escape them, not even light. Singularities are created when massive objects such as stars collapse under gravity. As such, their creation is governed by the laws of the very big stuff, general relativity. But because singularities themselves are so small, in fact, they're no bigger than a point, they also have to come under the influence of quantum mechanics. Hawking worked out that far from being black, because of quantum mechanics, black holes were in fact glowing. They emitted a very strange form of radiation named after Hawking himself, Hawking radiation. To unearth some of the detail of Professor Hawking's early work, I spoke to one of his colleagues at Cambridge University, Harvey Real. I put it to him that we normally think of black holes as voracious eaters and destroyers, leaving nothing in their path untouched.
Well, the statement that black holes are completely black and don't emit anything is a statement about black holes in general relativity, which is a classical theory. It doesn't take account of quantum mechanics.
And that's just down to gravity.
Exactly. A black hole, by definition, is a region of space and time from which nothing can escape. So, by definition, nothing can get out of a black hole. But quantum mechanically, Stephen showed that in fact, a very small amount of radiation can get out of a black hole. I say very small because if you consider a black hole of the type that's believed to form in our universe, then the temperature of that radiation is incredibly tiny. It's a tiny fraction of a degree above absolute zero. So the rate at which stuff is getting out of the black hole is incredibly small, but there is this tiny trickle of particles coming out of the black hole, according to this discovery.
Once you have a black hole emitting radiation, does it affect the size of the black hole?
Yes. So as the black hole emits radiation, it will gradually lose energy, and as a consequence, it will shrink. And if you just had a black hole sitting on its own in empty space and waited long enough, then it eventually would shrink to zero. For a realistic black hole, this would be an incredibly long time, much longer than the age of the universe so far. But in theory, that's what will happen. The black hole will shrink to zero eventually. What happens then is still mysterious. To explain what would happen to a black hole when it got very small towards the end of its life, we would need a quantum theory of gravity, which we do not yet have. And this is one of the reasons why this discovery was one of the, perhaps the major milestone in the construction of a quantum theory of gravity.
The search for a quantum version of gravity and for some observations of Professor Hawking's theoretical predictions are amongst the biggest challenges for modern physics. But as Stephen Hawking said in his opening address, he was much better at taking toy trains apart than putting them together. It's up to the imagination of experimental scientists. With giant telescopes in the desert and underground machines such as the Large Hadron Collider to solve the problems dreamed up by the professor and his colleagues in theoretical physics. But in assessing his contribution and the praise that he receives, Stephen Hawking's determination and willpower was always singled out by those closest to him. As I found out when speaking to Cambridge physicist and longtime Hawking collaborator, Professor Gary Gibbons.
Several decades. What is the most compelling thing about Professor Hawking that people around the world seem to love and adore him as a physicist, maybe don't know exactly what he does, but they know him. What is it about him that's most compelling to you?
Well, that's difficult to say. I mean, of course, you know, his great courage and his imagination also and his desire to get to the bottom of things. I mean, in physics, that's the thing that would really characterize you. He makes many bold conjectures, some of which have turned out to be Correct, many of them. And he's really relentless in his pursuit of what he thinks is the right viewpoint. But he's also got enormous talents as a mathematical physicist, sharp insights, often geometrical or not needing enormous amounts of formulae. In his early career, he, of course, did write papers with lots of formulae, but as time went on, that became more difficult for him. His work became perhaps even more imaginative because he had to think it through in his head. So that gives the flavour of his work and why I think many professional physicists admire him so much. Of course, his personality is something that appeals to anyone. You don't need technical training, and I think he has a certain sense of humour and so forth, which is very natural. And then people perceive in him, I think, something which is that despite the great adversities he's facing, he's able to keep cheerful and also make a great contribution to the area of knowledge that he wishes to. So I think that's sort of picked up by people without knowing very much about what he actually is doing at the time.
You mentioned there his personality. All the people I've spoken to say that he's got a great sense of humour. How funny is this, Professor Hawking?
Well, it's a wry sense of humour, usually. You can always tell that he's cracking a joke because, face will light up and so forth. Yeah, I don't think it's a vulgar sense of humour or anything of that sort. It is the slightly unexpected phrase that he will use. And also he likes to be provocative. I think that's the most distinctive aspect. So what he will say will provoke people.
Around the time of my No Boundary work, I decided to write a popular book. I thought I might make a modest amount to help support my children at school and the rising costs of my care, but the main reason was because I enjoyed it. While I was writing it, I visited CERN and I became critically ill with pneumonia and lost my voice due to a tracheostomy. But I kept putting a lot of effort into the book because I think it's important for scientists to explain their work.
This capacity for humour and the drive to communicate drove Stephen Hawking to write a book, A Brief History of Time. This transformed the popular understanding of cosmology and theoretical physics. It also made him, it made him famous.
Yeah, my name is Peter Stringfellow. I've been in nightclubs for 50 years. I've met some very interesting people on my way. And that's the nicest thing I can say about being in nightclubs is having the capacity to be able to say hello to some of the most interesting people in the world, including Professor Stephen Hawking.
Yes, you heard right. Peter Stringfellow. Not the first person that would come to mind in any discussion of Professor Hawking. But not only does he have a passion for popular science, Peter Stringfellow once hosted Stephen Hawking at his eponymous London nightclub. The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample, who else, spoke to Peter about a very welcome visit by a great man of science.
Well, the Stephen Hawking story can be very long, but I'll try and pull it down for you. When I go into my nightclubs, my habit is to say to my management, is there anyone here I should know? Which is really a meaning, who do you want me to talk to? Is there somebody I should say hello to? Anybody famous or anybody you want to just to say hello? And I walked into my restaurant area of my nightclub and my maitre d' said, there's a gentleman over there. He is a film star. You know him. And I said, yes. And I went over and spoke to the A-class film star. Then he said, oh, Mr. Peter, there is a gentleman over there. I think maybe you know him too. And I looked over and there was a gentleman laid out in a long chair and surrounded by a couple of ladies and a gentleman. And I thought, that can't be. And now the most stupidest thing in the world was I actually thought it might have been a lookalike. I mean, how stupid is that? But then it dawned, that was Professor Stephen Hawking. So I walked over and introduced myself. And at that time, he was speaking through a voice box, which he was computed with his thumb. And I introduced myself and said, look, I'm delighted you're here. He was halfway through his dinner. And I said, when you finish, if you'd like to come over to my table, I'd love to say hello to you and have a chat and join you for a drink. Which he did. His assistant at the time was called Mark, and they brought Stephen over to my table. I was out of my mind. I couldn't believe that here I was sitting and talking, Professor Stephen Hawking. Now, before I met Stephen, he was my all-time hero for many, many reasons. So here he was, and I've met presidents of America, prime ministers, I met film stars, I met rock stars, you name them, I've probably met them. But this was the man that really took my breath away somewhat, you know. And we sat there and had a little chat. And then I remember saying to him, Stephen, it's absolutely amazing that you're in my club. A couple of years ago, I had the string theory explained to me by two scientists from Harvard in my New York club. So, you know, would you like to have a chat with me about that? Or would you just like to see the girl, watch the girls in my nightclub, which is, of course, a gentleman's club. And in those days, he could still smile, and he smiled, and he just came out with two words, the girls. I can't tell you. Here I am sitting with the man who knows everything in any human ever knows about the universe, and I'd love to talk to him, but he doesn't want to talk to you about the universe. He wants to watch the girls, which was just typical of what I expected of Stephen. Not only is he the most intelligent man in the world, but also on top of that, he's human. And he's not beyond the normal thoughts of human beings and people like myself. And I liked him even more after that. He smiled, and we smiled, and we had a laugh, and he was sipping champagne, believe it or not, through a straw, but nevertheless, he was enjoying himself, and that's how the night went.
Through the weekend of celebrations at Cambridge, Stephen's love of a party was clearly in evidence at the evening soirees and dinners. As the events got into full swing, and the good and the great of physics and cosmology started to unwind, we asked some of them to sum up their visions of the birthday boy.
I'm Ian Moss. I was Stephen's student back in the early 1980s. What impressed me about Stephen is he's absolutely brilliant. I mean, there's some people who are very clever, and you see their work and you think, well, if I worked really hard on that project, maybe I could have done that myself. And then there are people like Stephen, and you see his breakthroughs, and you think, there's no way I would have thought of that if I'd spent all my life thinking on that project. And I think that's the definition of genius. And I think he really is a genius.
Yeah, okay. I'm Jiří Bičák. I'm professor at Charles University in Prague. And I remember actually Steve from 1968 when I was giving a seminar or lecture in King's College in London. And he was in the audience, and already in those days, they said that he has 2 years or something like that. So I think he's simply a miracle in nature. And of course, he did a lot of very influential things, which helped to us, to relativists, as a field became popular and influential. So from, you know, entropy of black holes, of course, Hawking radiation, etc. But he did also quite a lot of work on cosmology, and as we learn here, he asked his students to do complicated work and things in the fields which he was not so much involved, like supergravity, supersymmetry, etc. So I believe that, this combination, of course, of his very handicapped physical situation with this enormous, ingenious, psychological or whatever, psychological and rational state is fantastic.
Well, I am Fernando Quevedo. I'm officially a professor here in Cambridge, but right now I'm the director of ICTP in Trieste. It's the International Center for Theoretical Physics. So I'm on leave for 5 years from here. So I have been knowing Stephen for many years since I was a student, and for me has been one of the most wonderful experiences of my life is to have an office just 10 steps from his office and see him on a daily basis. And I think he's a marvelous human being. People usually try to emphasize on his scientific achievements, but I would say you have to see him as a whole human being. There's a scientific part and a human part. So he struggles for life on a daily basis, so that's a big thing. And on top of that, he has been doing very important research over the years. He has achieved many things which are it will be lasting for many years to come. So in that sense, he's an outstanding scientist, but more than that, he's an outstanding human being, I would say. So.
My name is Peter Eichelberg. I'm a professor for theoretical physics at the University of Vienna. I first met Stephen Hawking in the early 80s, or even was in the 70s, mid-70s, in Trieste at the ICTP. At that time, his disease was just beginning. And I think one of the miracles is that he is still alive. His biggest achievement is certainly the radiation coming from a black hole, which is a quantum effect. And very recently in the Austrian radio, there was a discussion about him, whether he deserves the Nobel Prize. And the question, but for what the Nobel Prize? And of course, he has done outstanding scientific theoretical work, but the Nobel Prize is usually given for things that have been observed. And the Hawking radiation, so the radiation emitted from a black hole, has so far not been observed. So his main contributions are, first of all, together with Roger Penrose, the so-called singularity theorems, then his contribution for the radiating of a black hole, and the third thing is the no-boundary condition for quantum gravity. I think for all these things he will be remembered, and especially because of how a person can overcome a severe disease and nevertheless do excellent work.
In the glow of praise among Stephen Hawking's peers, it can't be underplayed how much of a miracle it seems to most of his contemporaries that he was able to overcome his form of motor neurone disease. As one of his colleagues told me, when I have a headache, I can't work, but Stephen can seem to work despite fantastic problems. And so we turn to his biographer, Kitty Ferguson, again. Kitty has a very close-up insight into the nature of Stephen's battle with his disease, and how the iconic computerized voice became identified with the mind of Hawking in the popular imagination.
Well, that happened gradually. He, first of all, was, I think, during that first year, when he was just discovering the diagnosis himself, people noticed that he had what seemed like a speech impediment. I think when Kip Thorne first met him, he thought, this is a young man with a speech impediment. And inexorably, it got worse and worse. He lost he lost the ability to walk. He had to go into a wheelchair. Eventually lost, as we know, in the 80s, he had to have his vocal cords removed so he couldn't talk anymore, has to work, do through the computer. It's been a gradual, fight and losing it all the way. But the interesting thing is that there are many, all along the line, first of all, when he had to go into a wheelchair, for instance, and other things like that. And now, as he faces perhaps looking at a different mode of communication, which would involve direct connections into the brain, which is one possibility. Now, I haven't talked to him about this, but he is resisting that. I know he is. And as he has resisted every, what we would think of as an advance along the way with dealing with his illness, because it seems like he's giving into it. It seems like a concession to his illness when he has to make the next step. Now, that's something he's dealt with again and again. But he's always been the one to make those decisions, not to let anybody else make those decisions for him when he moves to the next possibility.
At the moment, he's not using, the way he communicates is by using a muscle in his cheek, is that right?
Yes, that's right. When I was working with him back in 2000, he still had the use of his hands, and he could do that. He punched a little mouse-like device to choose the words, and now he moves the muscle in his cheek. I think it's one thing that's been really interesting about writing biography about him is that, we hear all these things about him, what he does, how he handled this and all this, and his science. And what really has struck me, that has made it wonderful to write that, is to see that continuum, as you say, from he was a wartime baby, and through his childhood, through that struggle when he first came to Cambridge, and all his science, his family, and all this, up until this amazing birthday. And to see it all in a line, to see it all as a continuum. I had never looked at his life like that before, and to see the gradual onslaught of his illness and the gradual more and more disability. His also his increasing desire to help other disabled people and to help them with their problems and then his increasing desire, and it seems to still be increasing, to share his science with the world, to put together these television specials, and to put together his books. It's become almost more important to him than his scientific work, is the sharing it with non-scientists.
What is it you find most compelling? You've known him for a long time, mm-hmm. and so what is it you find most compelling about him?
I think his astounding mind, which is just beyond belief, his intellect, what he's able to do, how he's able to think, the fact that, although there's so many brilliant scientists, he's one that really loves to run ahead of the pack. He loves to do that. He loves to go out on the speculative edge, going to be in the vanguard, you know, make sometimes rather outrageous and shocking suggestions, which everybody has to scurry around and get the mathematics together and see whether he's right. And it's that energy that he has, and that, again, this spirit of adventure and spirit of fun that he has. And then the fact that he is able to live with his disability and to, it's just the most astounding, good-humored dismissal of it. It's just dismissal of it. It's not as though he's triumphing over it. It's just as though it's not there.
As I said earlier, Professor Hawking himself was prevented from attending the symposium in his honour due to ill health. But in a pre-recorded talk titled A Brief History of Mine, he summed up his contributions to science. So we'll leave the final words to Stephen Hawking, and very inspiring they are too. But before we go, we'd like to extend our own congratulations to Professor Hawking on his 70th birthday. Happy birthday, Professor Hawking, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps. Our thanks also to Martin Williams, who helped with the interviews for this programme. Goodbye.
So let me finish by reflecting on the state of the universe. It has been a glorious time to be alive and doing research in theoretical physics. Our picture of the universe has changed a great deal in the last 50 years, and I'm happy if I have made a small contribution. The fact that we humans, who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come this close to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe is a great triumph. I want to share my excitement and enthusiasm about this quest. So remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.